The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, Let Lenny Love. It is late August, and Lenny Kravitz is relaxing in the most beautiful place on the earth, his home on Eleuthera Island in the Bahamas. Dressed in a black Adidas tracksuit, he's settling into his kitchen overlooking a coconut field, and beyond that, the azure blue sea. Kravitz, whose maternal grandfather is from the Bahamas, has captivated audiences with his Bohemian Rock and Soul since 1989 debut, Let Love Rule. 10 albums and 4 Grammys later, he is embarking on a new creative venture, Let Love Rule. A memoir, which is out now, focusing on the 25 years before he was a star, he describes a childhood filled with music and art. Duke Ellington, Cicely Tyson, Toni Morrison, and Diane Carroll all make appearances, but the most riveting pages feature Kravitz's parents and his former wife and muse, Lisa Bonet. In the memoir, Kravitz portrays his mother, Roxy Roker, as sunshine and love, deeply attuned to her son's needs. The Jeffersons actress created an alter ego named Ruff Ruff to act as Lenny's childhood confidant. My mother would ask if it was time to talk to Ruff Ruff, Kravitz recalls. She would change her voice and body language, and suddenly I would be talking to this magical dog. Other anecdotes are less heartwarming. The book's most chilling scene describes when Kravitz learned that his father, Cy, had been unfaithful. News he dutifully reported to his mom. As he packed his bags, Cy damned his only son to repeat his betrayal. You'll do it too, he warned. When asked about it now, Kravitz admits that his father's words haunted him for years. I didn't understand the way it would creep into my psyche, he says. The rocker doesn't share the struggles he may have had with infidelity. He does, however, devote the book's final chapters to his ex-wife, detailing their romance, the birth of their daughter, Zoe, now 32, and the enormous impact Bonet had on his career. The poetry of her soul excited the poetry of my soul, he writes. Late last summer, Kravitz posted a picture of himself and Bonet's current husband, Jason Momoa, on Instagram. Although he and Bonet divorced in 1993, social media erupted with breathless praise for this glorious vision of a blended family. Kravitz laughs. Yeah, Zoe and I were sharing Lisa Bonet memes after that, he says. But to me, this is normal. Lisa and I made sure to maintain the love and the family unit. Let love rule. That's what it is all about. The next article is titled, The Spectrum of Blackness. We are so used to reading and reflecting on history and what our ancestors endured that we sometimes forget that our children's children will soon be reading about us as our country faces one of the biggest racial reckonings of our lifetime. Black folks are constantly working to define, protect, and love ourselves. Our experience has always been challenging, to say the least, but we steadfastly continue to create, sing, write, cook, grow, build, and find the strength and even the joy to persevere and liberate ourselves. But who is documenting our collective journey? That was the question Jenna Wertheim, a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and co-host of the podcast Still Processing, had for the Brooklyn-based writer, curator, and activist Kimberly Drew in 2015. Like any good millennial, Wortham slid into at Museum Mammy, aka Drew's DMs. "It must be said, I love your Instagram. You are a dream queen." Their subsequent exchange led to a life-changing friendship and Black Futures, a brilliant archival project that delivers a wide-ranging portrait of our lives. We decided to link up for lunch and had a conversation about what cultural preservation means in a moment like this, says Drew. "So many Black creatives are making such incredible things. What can we do to bring light to what's happening?" As they embarked on commissioning pieces from more than 100 bold and dynamic Black contributors, they sought to capture the essence of being alive as a Black person right now. Throughout the 544 pages, a time capsule that includes full color art by an all-Black team and is published by a Black-led imprint, readers will discover how infinite and non-linear Blackness is. In Wortham and Drew's letter from the editors, they state, "On these pages, you will find screenshots, essays, manifestos, memes, artworks, poems, song lyrics, and creations of all types. Themes in this book will provoke you, entice you, enrage you, spark joy, and call you to action. There are many paths forward," Wortham says of the book. "We're not trying to say that we have our arms around building or defining a Black future. We just want everyone to be involved in the same project of documenting, preserving, archiving, iterating, and dreaming." The next article is titled History Maker. Senator Harris is on her way up to the media room. The message transmitting from the walkie-talkie clipped to our video producer's waist was my signal. On the second day of our 2019 Essence Festival of Culture, to get into position for our initial on-camera sit-down with Kamala Harris, then a presidential candidate. Though Harris's historic run for the seat of junior senator from California was immortalized in the pages of Essence's February 2016 issue, this interview, held above the bustling halls of the Ernest N. Moral Convention Center in New Orleans, would break new ground. Harris's career first had taken her from law enforcement to lawmaker, but in her run for president, the daughter of Shyamala Gopalan and Donald Harris became the first Black and South Asian American woman to ever make a bid on a major party ticket for the nation's highest office. It was obvious during our exchange that Harris understood what it would take to be successful. The only Black woman with a seat in the U.S. Senate entered our makeshift studio that Saturday afternoon in a tailored beige suit paired with her signature string of pearls and perfectly coiffed hair. Worth noting, given the heat of New Orleans in July. With her, she brought an assured manner, suggesting she was unmistakably ready to make her appeal to the familiar community of women served by our storied brand. Earlier, on the festival stage, she had proclaimed, "We are not going back to the time that Donald Trump insists was great, a time that was unkind to women and people of color. In fact, it is time to turn the page, and it is time to write the next chapter." During our 101, her message to the Black women at the center of that weekend was, "The power is in your hands to make the next chapter happen." Harris formally announced her entry into the presidential race in 2019 on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. At a kickoff rally in Oakland, days later, her candidacy evoked a level of excitement expected for such a significant occasion. By the time Harris talked with us at Essence Fest, just over 6 months later, more than two dozen people, including several of her colleagues in the Senate, had also chosen to enter an already crowded race. The fanfare over her bid was becoming to wane, and Harris's past as a prosecutor was becoming problematic for some black voters. On a bus tour through Iowa a month later, Harris told Essence that she was proud of the work she had done in her role as a district attorney of San Francisco and attorney general of California, and maintained that there is more than one way to change the system. I reject the notion that says if you try and fix the system from the inside, then you are somewhat suspect, she explained. She also noted during that August afternoon that her prosecutorial past gave her the chops to litigate the case against 4 more years of Donald Trump. Harris is undoubtedly liberal on environmental justice, criminal justice reform, immigration, housing, healthcare, HBCU funding, black entrepreneurship, and a host of other issues on the ballot for Black America in 2020. Yet, by the November debate, her standing in the race was uncertain. Barack Obama captured 96% of black women's votes in 2008. In 2012, black women voted at a higher rate than any other group across gender, race, and ethnicity, securing Obama's second term in the White House and giving Democrats 4 more years in the executive branch. Though a plurality of white women chose against Hillary Clinton in 2016, helping to usher in a Trump presidency, more than 95% of black women voted for the candidate who could have been the first woman president. In 2019, these numbers led Harris to acknowledge that the power to decide the 2020 election would come down to the core voting bloc of the Democratic Party, black women. The morning after the Atlanta debate last November, and just hours before she would kick off a Black Women Weekend of Action in South Carolina, Harris convened a packed room at the Westin Peachtree Plaza for a Black Women's Power breakfast. There, she openly answered questions about her electability and connected with voters who may or may not have solidified their support for the Howard University grad. The conversation about electability is, I just don't know if America is ready for a black woman to be president of the United States, Harris said, mimicking some doubters. I'm ready, is what they say. I just don't know if my neighbor is ready. Weeks later, citing financial concerns, Harris decided to bow out of the race. 9 months later, the question would be boldly reframed. Is the country ready for a black woman vice president? After Harris exited the race, former Vice President Joe Biden committed to selecting a woman to be his running mate. On August 11th, after considering a number of highly qualified contenders, he decided on Harris. He had also staffed his campaign with several other high-profile black women. In her first 3 interviews after being named Biden's running mate, Harris sat down with black women journalists. During her time with Essence, the lawmaker some have labeled too moderate confirmed that radical change was on the Biden-Harris agenda. There is no question that we need immediate change and drastic change, and that's so much of what the Biden-Harris platform and what the Biden-Harris administration will be about, she insisted. It is about saying we need to immediately address a number of issues that demand priority, and that relates to getting people back to work. It means investing in infrastructure and creating millions of new jobs. It means fighting for health care for all people. In the first half of 2020, Harris, who ranked by the nonpartisan organization GovTrack as the most liberal compared to all senators, emerged as a staunch advocate for small businesses, a fighter for protections for uninsured workers, and an activist for social justice. When protesters flooded the streets of the nation days after the police-involved death of George Floyd and 2 months after the killing of Breonna Taylor, Harris was there, donning a mask, saying their names along with those of countless other victims of police violence. I have seen too many cases of not only unarmed black folks being killed, but women, Harris said in her August interview with Essence. We need to speak their names and understand that we have to have justice. The November election was long believed to be an indicator of how swiftly justice would come for the victims of state-sanctioned violence, for more than 400 years of inequity in the Black community, for those afflicted by systemic racism. I firmly in my heart and in my soul know that this is the most important election of our lifetime. Harris stated with conviction hours before the Democratic National Convention. There are such big issues there that are on the line. Harris noted that her first foray into elected leadership was at Howard University. And when you run for public office at Howard University, you can run for office anywhere, she said. She has proven that point many times over in her successful races for district attorney, for attorney general, and for the U.S. Senate. All those campaigns gave her the grit needed in her bid for the presidency. November 3rd determined who would serve the next 4 years as president and vice president. But even before the votes were cast, Kamala Harris had made history. The next article is titled, Knowledge is Power. In recognition of World AIDS Day on December 1st, arm yourself with these important tips on preventing, managing, and supporting those with HIV/AIDS. It's been nearly 40 years since the emergence of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in America. While there have been many important advancements in testing and treatment over the years, the best first step, besides abstinence, is still to know the facts. As recently as 2018, Blacks made up 42% of new HIV diagnoses, according to the CDC. Given that we comprise just 13% of the general population, we are the most affected group, which suggests we have a lot to talk about within our community. We asked HIV experts about getting tested, preventative treatments, and educating the younger generation on HIV. Here are 6 things you need to know. Number 1. The CDC recommends that testing begin as early as age 13 and suggests advocating for HIV testing at least once a year if you are at a higher risk, as well as before become sexually active with a new partner. Testing can be done in your health care provider's office, at a community health center, or at home with an FDA-approved test. Number 2, know the difference between a PrEP and a PEP. PrEP is a daily pre-exposure prophylaxis medicine that is taken constantly, helps protect against HIV infection. It is given to those who are at risk but who are not already HIV positive. A PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, is part of antiretroviral therapy, also known as ART. It works to keep the virus load in an HIV positive person low enough that there is no risk of transmitting the virus through sex. It is also taken after potential exposure to HIV to stave off infection. Tina Hoff, director of Greater Than AIDS, says PrEPs are highly effective when taken as prescribed, and ARTs have been around for years, helping people with HIV to live long, healthy lives. Number 3, Khadija Abdullah, founder and executive director of RAMA, Reaching All HIV Plus Muslims in America, works to destigmatize HIV, especially in faith communities. She notes that family support is crucial. Be non-judgmental of HIV-positive family members, she says. Don't ask how they became positive. Ask how you can help them navigate their diagnosis. Often, the first reaction people who are diagnosed receive, especially from loved ones, is critical. This can set the course for how they perceive and care for themselves from then on. Empower them toward a positive future, Abdullah says. Number 4, overall, reported HIV cases are decreasing in the United States. According to the CDC, in 2018, there were 37,968 HIV diagnoses in the U.S., a 7% decrease from 2014, notes Dr. Eugene McCrae, director of the CDC Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention. The decline seen in these reports suggests that national HIV prevention efforts are paying off in some populations. However, increases among other groups and in certain geographic areas signal an urgent need to expand and improve HIV prevention and treatment. Number 5. In 2018, the CDC reported that 21% of new diagnoses were in youth ages 13 through 24. Dr. McCrae attributes the challenges in preventing HIV among young people to inadequate sex education, low rates of testing, substance use, and low rates of condom use, among other factors. Informing the next generation starts with conversations about safety and with encouraging young people to get themselves tested. Number 6, accurate information about HIV is essential. As what we know about HIV changes, it is important to consult trustworthy sources. To find out more about the latest in HIV testing, preventative medicine, and treatment, visit cdc.gov and visit greaterthan.org, and you can also visit hiv.gov. The next article is titled, A Healthy with Patti LaBelle. Just in time for National Diabetes Month, Miss Patti has an easy recipe your entire family will love. When you think of legendary singer Patti LaBelle, you might remember her mouth-watering sweet potato pies that went flying off the shelves back in 2015. For the festive season, this music icon is sharing the quote-unquote new attitude she adapted in the kitchen some time ago. Your holiday fare can be both wholesome and delicious. LaBelle, who was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in 1995, has changed her diet considerably over the years. She uses her culinary skills to discover fresh, healthy dishes that don't skimp on flavor. I am incorporating better foods for my family while I am here at home, LaBelle says. Instead of fried chicken, I will saute or bake it. My saviors are hot peppers and fresh garlic because they heighten the flavor of all my meals. One of LaBelle's dishes that became an instant hit with her granddaughter Gia is her sauteed braisino. Gather around the table and feed your body and soul with Miss Patti's juicy family-style creation. All you will need are a few simple ingredients that are likely already in your pantry. With just a dash of fresh garlic, turmeric powder, and salt and pepper, this flaky fish comes together in a flash. Pan-seared braisino. Add one of Miss Patti's knockout dishes to your menu. Makes 4 servings. Ingredients: 4 skin-on braisino fillets, 1 pound, 2 tablespoons of fresh garlic minced, coarse salt, coarse black pepper, 1 teaspoon of turmeric powder, 1 teaspoon of ground cayenne pepper, optional for a spicier flavor, 2 to 3 tablespoons of grapeseed oil, depending on the size of the fillets. Pat the fillets dry with a paper towel. Sprinkle the fillets on both sides with garlic, salt, pepper, turmeric, and cayenne pepper, and set aside. Heat the oil in a large skillet over medium-high heat. Place the fish skin down in the pan. Cook for 3 to 4 minutes. Then carefully flip and cook for another 3 to 4 minutes. Place the fish on a paper towel lined plate to remove any excess oil, then serve promptly. The next article is titled, Celebrating Resilience. As Sister Zora Neale Hurston wrote in her masterpiece, Their Eyes Were Watching God, there are years that ask questions and years that answer. The now infamous 2020 did both, making it quite a paradox. The year kicked off on a supremely hopeful note. We stood at the dawn of a new decade with hearts full of excitement and focus. Collectively, we envisioned becoming more like the selves we have always longed to be. Then 2020 flipped the script. With each month that passed, there seemed less to celebrate and more to grieve and process. The unrelenting chaos of the pandemic, along with the racial strife, brought us many tough emotions to swallow. First, a fear of the unknown. then nonstop rage over the realization that very little has truly changed in this country for black folks. We suffered one heartbreak after another as we watched our brothers and sisters being murdered in the streets and in their homes at the hands of the police, and then saw the acts replayed on national news with justice again denied. Without a question, 2020 will go down in the history books as the year when everything changed in the world and yet not enough changed for us. We will always remember the many lives we lost to the COVID-19 pandemic and shake our heads in disbelief over also losing the Black Mamba and the Black Panther, Kobe Bryant and Chadwick Boseman. We will recall the global marches and the fight for racial justice, and how in the midst of them, we lost several great freedom fighters, including civil rights icon and activist Congressman John Lewis. Despite the many horrors, I know black people will also tell a tale of strength, of how we never grew weary as we pursued justice for Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, and Jacob Blake. How we said their names again and again. We will talk about what we gained from all the loss and how we survived in spite of it. How, when we could not hug or touch each other for months, we became more intentional about communication and togetherness, writing letters, sending cards, and setting up video calls to connect and share love. It became our new normal, despite the frustrations that arose from being frontline workers during an unprecedented and scary time, or juggling full-time remote work with helping our children learn and grow from home, we turned those experiences into unforgettable family memories and bonds. When the government left many of us with little to no economic relief to mitigate the damage done by the pandemic, we became gardeners, returning to tilling the earth to feed ourselves and one another. For the past months, black women have done what we always do. We survived. In a year that sought to break us, some of us even thrived. We may not be coming out of it having accomplished everything on our vision boards, but that's okay, because we are going into this new year with an even greater awareness of our own power and capacities. Go ahead and applaud yourself, because you were able to find moments of glorious joy buried deep inside a difficult time. As we reconcile what has transpired, more tears will undoubtedly flow. We will all be sitting with the weight of this for a good long while. But may we remember all of it, the good, the bad, and the feelings that cannot be put into words. May we hold all of its confirmation of a beautiful and powerful truth about ourselves. To come through all of this and live to tell the story, we are more amazing than we know. Have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Ava Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.